Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Swiftly moving and richly detailed, one of the most dramatic spy stories of the Cold War. Now in our next segment, we're going to discuss a tremendous book. One of the best spy books I've ever read. It is the true story of the most daring Allied operation of the Cold War, the successful construction in the early 1950s of a tunnel into East Berlin to tap and record KGB and Soviet military communications. And here to talk to us about it is the author of Betrayal in Berlin, Steve Vogel. Steve, welcome.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, man, I have to admit, when I was reading through the press kit on this one, this thing would be incredibly interesting, not only to myself, but several members of my family, because we share that in common. We're both sons of people of the pickle factory. And anytime you know somebody that's worked in and around the intelligence services, it's interesting because you know very little about them or their service, rather. And before we dive into the book, share with me why this touches home and why writing this book really spoke to your heart.
Yeah, well, my dad was stationed in Berlin as a CIA officer in the 1950s, and I ended up being born there in 1960, which was a little bit too late for the Berlin Tunnel, but on time, in fact, in advance of the Berlin Wall, which was built about a year after I was born. No coincidence, my dad used to say, but yeah, exactly. But yeah, I didn't, of course, know then, and I didn't know for a long time until I was in high school that he actually worked for the CIA. And, you know, like a lot of kids of CIA officers, I didn't know really anything about what he did because it was undercover work, and he died a long time ago. So I never had a chance to talk to him about that stuff. But did learn over the years bits and pieces from some of his friends and colleagues, and who stayed very close to our family. So I just decided, as a journalist, I wanted to find out more about what was going on back in the heyday of the Cold War in Berlin.
Indeed, and not just a journalist, but you've worked for the Washington Post. You've covered the fall of the Berlin Wall, and actually you were there for several years covering the follow-up to the fall of the wall. But the book Betrayal in Berlin is set in the 1950s, and it really is at this dangerous, almost nervous moment between us and the Soviet Union. And I'll just kind of paraphrase here before I let you take over, but the code name Operation Gold was a wildly audacious CIA plan to construct a tunnel beneath the wall to East Berlin to intercept Soviet communications. I got to say that, you know, we were at a time in America and global politics when, like, the world was tense, and we were almost fearing its inevitable end with weapons and nukes and all this stuff. Share with me where we begin with Betrayal in Berlin.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of a uniquely vulnerable time, I think, in American history. I mean, we, of course, come out of World War II as the kings of the world, and had the sole atomic capability, but the Soviets had stolen some of the secrets of the Manhattan Project and exploded their own weapon in 1949. And a few years later, they had a hydrogen bomb as well. They also had a massive force, conventional army force, that was in Eastern Europe, in East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, that was, you know, on a war footing, ready to go into Western Europe if it came to that. And we didn't have any of the types of intelligence, really, that we think of today. I mean, this was the U-2 was not yet available. We didn't have that overhead surveillance. Plus, we had, of course, no satellites. We didn't even have much in the way of human spies behind the Iron Curtain, because it had been so difficult in the police states that existed in the Soviet Union in particular, but also East Germany. Getting agents set up back there who weren't quickly captured. So we were more or less blind as to what the Soviets might intend. And Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was president, really feared a nuclear Pearl Harbor might happen.
Now, as we took steps to remedy that, and we really wanted to get to know what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, we wanted to track and see what our new nemesis was up to. Your story just documents so many different angles of this tunnel. But essentially, a tunnel was being built, and there was a key player in this whole thing that was an agent that turned on us who is British. Share with us a little bit of that storyline.
Sure. Yeah. Well, this tunnel was, you know, the answer to the problem. Basically, they came up with this idea of digging a tunnel from the American sector in Berlin into the Soviet sector and tapping into the Soviet Red Army communication lines that ran pretty close to the American sector border. Now, you know, at this time, this is before the wall, so I mean, there was more or less free access back and forth across the sector. So Berlin was a big espionage center, but the tunnel was going to intercept these three large trunk cables that carried a massive amount of Red Army and also some KGB traffic. And it seemed like we needed to work with the British on this for a couple of reasons. Partly they had done a series of smaller tunnels in Vienna and really had the technical expertise that we lacked. Plus, the British were very interested in doing their own tunnel, and so the CIA and MI6, or the British Secret Intelligence Service, as it was known, agreed to work together on this. And this was such a close-hold project that it was really only a handful of people in the CIA and in the British SIS that knew about this. And George Blake, a fascinating guy, as you allude to, he was actually someone who had been in the Dutch resistance during World War II as a young courier for the Dutch resistance. His mother was Dutch. His father had fought for the British Army in World War I and gained British citizenship. He was from Turkey originally. But Blake, after fearing arrest by the Nazis, had escaped all the way across Europe, you know, across the snowy Pyrenees mountains and into to get to England. And he's recruited by the British intelligence because, you know, he speaks lots of languages. He's pretty adept working behind enemy lines, that sort of thing. And he ends up getting sent to Korea just before the Korean War breaks out. And he's taken prisoner along with a number of other British and American diplomats, journalists, missionaries, and he survived some very brutal treatment, particularly early on, this death march, where a number of American GIs died due to the brutal conditions that they were being subjected to. Mm. But during that time, Blake decides that he's changing sides. He decides to approach the Soviets, you know, via the North Koreans and make an offer of espionage. And he called it an ideological conversion. And whatever the reason, the net result was that when Blake came back after his release from Korea in 1953, he was put into a highly sensitive position with SIS, which made him one of the very few handful of people who knew about this tunnel.
So the roots of the double agent, or the roots of Blake there, he actually joined the Soviets while he was being held prisoner. And I read in another interview that you had done, you said that Blake was quoted as saying, if people spied for their principal, those are the really dangerous kind. People that spy for money are really rather shallow, but the people that spied for principle are the, mm-hmm. you know, the ones that can really do some damage. Do you think he had an ideological principle that he favored communism, or was it just something to get him out of that torturous situation in North Korea, and he was willing to join any team to just get out of Korea?
We'll never know for certain. I personally, and many others, including actually the judge who ended up sentencing him years later to prison, believe that it was ideological. There's really no evidence otherwise. There's some speculation, but it seems that he had some. Even though he was raised as as someone who hated communism, he began seeing things. He spent a few years as a child in Egypt. He saw the great disparities in wealth there. Some of the people he was in contact with when he was held prisoner, had some very, deep conversations about the appeals of Marxism to the hungry of the world. I think fundamentally Blake didn't necessarily believe in, the Western approach to communism. He thought we should be working more closely, trying to help some of the less fortunate in the world. Now, a lot of people say that was complete hokey, and maybe he did it to save his life. But as I say, we'll never know for certain.
Well, we're going to get to something in just a moment that is actually mind-blowing because you met the man. But before we get there, fast forward from the POW camp in the Korean War, and then, of course, he takes this position somehow, some way, as the Soviets led him to safety with the British. And there he is, a high-ranking officer. And explain to me kind of how he's now connected to this tunnel project, because it wasn't immediately known what he had done, right?
No. So he comes back in April of 1953 back to England, and this is just as the tunnel project is kind of kicking into high gear, and he's assigned to this special new section in the British Secret Intelligence Service. It's called Section Y, type top secret little endeavor that was in charge of tunnel type operations, where the British were trying to exploit electronic surveillance, tapping lines, and this was something that they were trying to do on a larger scale. So by virtue of that assignment, he ends up going to a meeting with the CIA, with Bill Harvey, who was one of the principal leaders on the American side in with the CIA on this tunnel. And he's the guy at this meeting taking notes, and at the same time that he's holding this position, he's holding regular meetings with a KGB contact in London. So he's able early on to alert the KGB to what the Americans and British are planning.
Amazing. So then years go by, and of course, we deem this tunnel operation as a huge success in America, kind of wins back some cred for the CIA. Everybody's like, yay, look at us taking it to the Russians. We're still the biggest, baddest force ever been. And then it comes to light that they'd known all along that we were making that tunnel because of Blake.
Yeah. He had alerted the KGB about it before the tunnel was even built. So there's a real irony here. And this presented the KGB with a huge dilemma, because Blake was proving himself so valuable as a spy, in a very sensitive position in British intelligence, and so few people knew about this tunnel, that the KGB, and when we say the KGB, we're talking about, three or four people at the KGB, very senior people, knew about this tunnel, but they didn't want to do anything that was going to jeopardize Blake. So they made the decision not to do anything. In other words, Their feeling was, okay, these are the Red Army's lines. They're not so much really our KGB lines. And they decide to, not do anything to block the tunnel. And they don't do anything other than issue some oblique warnings to the senior Red Army commanders that, hey, by the way, you might want to watch your telephone security. But the amount of the volume of material that was going through these lines is astonishing. Thousands and thousands of calls every day, teletype communications from the lowest clerks to the highest, the commander of all Soviet forces in Germany, who's in charge of these 400,000 troops that are based there. They're having their calls intercepted, and they're oblivious to the fact. And the you know, there's speculation later that, oh, well, this, you know, the Soviets must have just thrown a bunch of disinformation on those lines. It would have been impossible to, you know, put some disinformation in there because so many of the calls would have been legitimate information. They couldn't fake, you know, 400,000 calls that it quickly would have been discovered as being, you know, something that had been planted. You know, in the end, the KGB was afraid to do anything to jeopardize Blake.
So in a way, we actually both kind of won something here. We got some valuable intelligence by listening to them and being able to create the tunnel. And they actually had a win because they were able to put a mole in the entire operation that, you know, we were so blind to for years. I mean, it didn't even come out until the 60s that Blake had turned on us and had given up the tunnel very early on. You'd done incredible research for this. Talk to me about what ends of the earth you had to go to uncover all these documents and the things that contribute to the book Betrayal in Berlin.
You know, a lot of the research was done here in the U.S., and including I found some of the Army, U.S. Army Corps of Engineer officers who were in charge of this project who never told their story. And, you know, so I traveled around interviewing some of these guys, went out to Tennessee to talk to one of the captains in charge of the project. A lot of information that was from the CIA, some of the records they'd released in recent years, and other stuff obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests. I also went, of course, overseas to Britain, where a number of records existed, including Blake's trial record, held at the Imperial War Museum, and other records at the National Archives in Kew outside of London. And I was able to find a lot of the CIA officers and British intelligence officers who were involved. And, you know, one of the most legendary was a gentleman named Hugh Montgomery, who was in the CIA for some 50 years, only died recently. And he was more or less the number two guy for Bill Harvey on the tunnel in Berlin, and he had some amazing details. And some of the communication engineers and others who were involved in translating, you know, who were sitting there in this big American warehouse that they built across from the where the tunnel was tapping the lines, and that's where they had all these 150 tape recorders running, just the constant stream of calls being recorded, and they were listening to them live oftentimes to try to find any sign of a Soviet attack or any sign that the Soviets had learned about this tunnel. I also spoke to George Blake, wasn't able to meet with him personally, but spoke to him twice. I went out to Moscow to his dacha, where he lives outside of Moscow. He was ill at that time, so I couldn't meet with him, but spoke to him on the phone. We talked about the tunnel. He, of course, had this spectacular escape from prison in London in 1966 and made his way to Moscow eventually, and has been living there ever since. So
let me just click pause real quick and say, you've actually found Blake and got him to tell you more about his story, about how he escaped from prison and then ended up living in Moscow all these years. You found the original Soviet mole and spoke with him.
Yeah, it was
tremendous.
It was exciting. I mean, he's someone who's pretty mild-mannered and pleasant to speak with, but I think that's one of the things that made him very dangerous as a mole, because people couldn't fathom him being a spy. He wasn't, you know, some brash guy. He wasn't like, say, Kim Philby, who, you know, later a lot of people thought, oh yeah, okay, I can see that. You know, Blake was someone that the British thought was above suspicion, and so when they were hunting for a mole, they just didn't think it could be him initially. Yeah, so that was an interesting experience talking to him. Mm. He's 96 years old now and not in the best health, but you know, he's the only one of the Soviet the British traitors who is still living. You know, all the others, Donald McLean and Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, and all those guys have long since died, but you know, Blake is still there at 96.
this story was given to you or was researched in details given to you by several people, some of which you've mentioned, Hugh Montgomery, various other people, linguists and other engineers that worked on the project. They were all in their 80s or 90s and have since passed away, since you were able to document their interviews. So tremendous research that you kind of got on their, I don't want to say deathbed, but in their last years, they shared with you. Why do you think they did that? Do you think this was just something that they wanted to get off their chest, or?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases, I mean, they had felt, it was classified operation still until really about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And so they didn't, you know, they felt they weren't allowed to. And I think now they felt like this might be their last chance to, you know, tell the real story about what had happened and, you know, what they did. I don't think any of these guys were really seeking glory. I mean, you don't really do that if you go to work for the CIA, because almost everything you do is going to be totally cloaked in anonymity. But, you know, they kind of just wanted to set the record straight and you know, leave the best record they could at this point for history.
Well, it's an amazing story. I mean, it would make an even more amazing movie. I could see this thing being a silver screen blockbuster and, you know, it's part Jason Bourne, part just, you know, really incredible period piece from one of the most nervous moments in our history. But it's not just about history. And in fact, the day and age we live in today, you've said in so many words, is very similar. Talk to me about why this is relevant, especially today, considering where we are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, with all the talk of Russia and Russian intelligence and election meddling, you know, a lot of what this was about was trying to win the hearts and minds of, or undermine the other side in terms of, you know, the Russians were always kind of interested in undermining democracy. That was a lot of what they were doing, what the KGB was up to in Berlin in those years. And one of the things that they tried to do with the tunnel once they exposed it, which was after nearly a year of operation, they made this huge press propaganda thing out of it. You know, they called in every reporter in Berlin. They took them down in the tunnel. They, you know, used this to make the case that the Americans, they're only using Berlin as a nest of spies. You know, they're completely uncaring about the German people. They're just using Berlin as a base to spy. And this is another reason why the Allies should be thrown out of Berlin. This was, of course, an important goal of the Soviets. Berlin was more or less a weak point for them. This was the one place that the Western Allies still had a foothold behind the Iron Curtain. If the U.S. was forced to withdraw its forces from Berlin, we would have lost, you know, not only this beacon of democracy, Berlin, this island in the midst of East Germany, but we would have lost one of our most important bases for conducting espionage. So, you know, partly what the Soviets were saying is right. We did need Berlin as a base for espionage, but it was also much more than that. It was also, you know, the place where the flag of democracy was flying most notably, and that's why Berlin was such a focal point for the Cold War, and why you ultimately had the wall being built, because the Soviets failed to use the tunnel as a way to get force out the Western Allies. So in the end, they built a wall, but that ultimately leads to the collapse of the East German state and undermines the Soviet Union, which itself falls apart 2 years later.
And as we've seen the wall fall apart, we've seen Berlin change, we've seen all these dynamics change over the successive decades. One thing maybe hasn't changed, and this is where maybe I'd like you to kind of spitball with me here, but is the Cold War still in effect? All the news about Russian meddling and all the news about, you know, social media and how, you know, we're kind of at war on a different level. But are we, in fact, still battling? And is there still a real danger that the men and women in the intelligence industry are facing every day?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, yes, it did not. You know, this Cold War is, you know, what's going on today is a continuation of what was going on 40, 50, 60 years ago. I mean, it's really, it's a new Cold War, I think is a more accurate way to put it. And obviously it's not between so much ideologies, but it's more of a, you know, the Russians are, of course, they are trying to undermine democracy in Western Europe through, you know, what they've done in elections and all through the most recent European Union elections. There was a lot of meddling going on. They're also trying, of course, to undermine our elections in the United States. From that standpoint, yeah, this is, I think, a very dangerous period. I mean, we're seeing a lot of faith in democracy being undermined when people don't have faith in their elections, when they don't have faith that their leaders are the people that, you know, the people have chosen to represent them. It's a threat to I think our country and to Western democracy in general.
I guess as a military veteran myself, I look at it through that kind of lens, and I suspect that we are fighting this Cold War with drone technology in remote parts of the Earth, and we are fighting it with cyber technology, and there's people in computer technological centers deep within a mountain somewhere that are actually watching real-time internet servers and chatter on the dark web and all these things that are adding up to, like, Russian intervention, and it makes me question what I'm actually seeing in the news at times. Do you think some of what we're seeing now, and this is completely speculative, but the stories of President Trump and the Ukraine and all these things, are these all facets of what could be considered a greater intelligence war that's playing out in the headlines of major newspapers and news networks across the country?
Well, clearly the intelligence services on both sides are, you know, play a key role in the stories we're seeing. So, yeah, very much so. This is an intelligence battle that's going on, and we see that in the headlines almost every day. And the tunnel, it's interesting. And another aspect where the tunnel was kind of a precursor for some of the things that we see today is, you know, we live in this era now of mass surveillance, NSA and, you know, other agencies. And in a way, that the tunnel was kind of this early attempt at mass surveillance. You know, they weren't just tapping a couple of lines of, you know, this general or that clerk. They were tapping everybody's conversations. And I think that has set the stage for where we are today, where, you know, communications all around the world are being intercepted. And we know, our intelligence services know what's being said in conversations between the leaders of different countries. I think that's playing on the stories today, because, don't assume that what you're saying isn't being heard somewhere.
The danger of faulty assumptions. It's actually a quote from you that I've taken from another interview as well. And you've definitely nailed it. Are there moments when you work at a huge news organization like the Washington Post or something, are there moments that reporters get leads, or people that are on the defense beat, or people that are on the international beat station somewhere else? Are there sometimes leads that are given to them by intelligence communities?
Oh, I think that is happening. I think certainly, I mean, that is something that, Russian intelligence has tried to do, and not just targeting journalists, but, you know, people in general, because, you know, nowadays with social media, you can just go around the news organizations and, you know, put things out there on Facebook or Twitter that end up getting, you know, as much or if not more circulation than what you see on the so-called, you know, mass media, legitimate media organizations. So, yeah, I think going back to certainly in the 50s and the time I write about, there was certainly efforts by the KGB to plant stories, you know, to kind of cultivate journalists and try to get false narratives out there. And, you know, that's one of the really tricky things for any reporter, is to, you have to figure out where this information is coming from. You of course can't just take it at face value, but, you know, if information is being doctored, it becomes a very, very tricky and, you know, potentially dangerous route that you can go down.
What's old is new again. That's just an amazing story. Steve Vogel, the book is Betrayal in Berlin, the true story of the Cold War's most audacious espionage operation, a tunnel underground in Berlin and a British traitor that you actually tracked down some 50 years later. Great stuff, Steve. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime. Come back and be a guest. I could just talk more about conspiracy theories and espionage and the intelligence community in the world we live in today. I could talk about it all day with you.
Yeah, likewise. I really enjoyed it, Phil. It's a great conversation. Happy to do it again sometime.
Steve Vogel, Betrayal in Berlin. The book is on shelves everywhere you find books.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.